Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Shawley. Don't worry, we're not going to talk about it at all. Instead, forget England, we're going to talk about Scotland on the podcast today. If you were listening to Ruth Davidson on the episode last Thursday, you'd have heard her scolding me, not really understanding all of this union business and what really goes on in Scotland and all of that. So what we thought we'd do, we've got Kieran Andrews, the Times Scottish political editor. He's going to come in and tell us five things we really need to know about Scottish politics. So you'll be all clued up by the end of that. But first, as ever, it's our columnist panel. It's Monday, so it must be Liberace. It's Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester.
So we've just been hearing from Gareth Southgate giving his reaction to the defeat last night to Italy, but reconfirming he's just a class act, isn't he, Libby?
Absolutely. Extraordinary class act. And I have to say, I was watching last night sort of with a cat on my lap, kind of clutching this poor cat so it squeaked, that you watch the Italy manager and his wild gestures and his hands flailing and his scowls and his agony, you know, could sympathise with him. But then you look at Gareth Southgate and there he is kind of calm, just a slight sort of scowl and a slight little nod here and there. And I do love a calm chap, and I think I've loved the feeling of it all, and the England team, and the hugging, and the, you know, just that whole sort of sense of comradeship and of decency about it. So it's been, yeah, Southgate, he's a lot of credit to take for all that.
Yeah, having watched him last night, you definitely wouldn't want to play poker against him. Given if he can, with the world's, you know, watching him, he can not flinch. When either a goal was scored or not, it was quite something. Let's reflect, Rachel, on some of his remarks about we've been a beacon of light in bringing people together, but obviously not everyone, and some of the disgusting racist abuse which has been aimed at some of his players overnight. What can we do about that?
Well, first thing to say is he's right that this team has been a kind of beacon of light and a sort of symbol of inclusivity, tolerance, all those things that he wrote about in that brilliant letter. And those three players who missed the penalties are absolutely part of that. You think of those, what they've done, Marcus Rashford, how much money he's raised, how he's changed lives for all those millions of children who are hungry. This abuse is just completely... it's just not where the majority of the public is, I think. And I do think it also makes the point that all these politicians who are criticising the players for taking the knee, well, actually, you know, these players have got a point, and by doing things like that, that is taking a stand against that racism. But I think the social media companies need to take much more responsibility. You know, they're very good at targeting all of us with adverts for the favourite dress we might have once looked at online. They managed to track that down and send it to us, speaking personally. So they, why on earth can they not deal with this racist abuse? Those people, there shouldn't be anonymity. So people should be identified so they can be prosecuted if they're racist, and they should be banned. And also the social media companies, if they should be fined if they allow this sort of thing to happen. They are publishing stuff that we as a newspaper would never be allowed to publish, rightly. So there needs to be much tougher action on them and much tougher action on the people who put this stuff out there. And they shouldn't be able to hide under the cloak of anonymity.
I think this is all obviously absolutely right, that the anonymity is absurd, and it has been absurd for ages. But what is annoying me slightly is the incredible publicity that is being given to these gits who sort of put up monkey emojis and the rest of it, because lots and lots, the internet is all full of stories of people sort of laughing together on tubes and people applauding and a girl wrapped in the Italy flag, and you know, there's not a lot of there are not a lot of really, really horrible morons around. You know, they are there, and they should be tracked down, and they should be banned from the, you know, prosecuted and banned from social media and so on. But we are kind of blowing it up enormously into Britain is still evil. And I think this is a really wrong thing to do.
I think you're right, Libby, actually, that you can't, to give them publicity is a mistake. It's like, I think there was a streaker rushed onto the pitch last night, and they don't show that, do they? Because they don't want to give publicity. It's a sort of, these idiots are the equivalent of that, but obviously a much more sinister version. But I think, you know, obviously they should be prosecuted, but they also shouldn't be, in a sense, given that oxygen of publicity.
What about the politics of this? Because you've got Boris Johnson and Priti Patel out saying this is, you know, condemning people posting racist abuse. But they were willing to side with the people who were booing the taking of the knee only a couple of weeks ago. Libby?
Well, everybody makes a complete idiot fool of themselves sometimes, don't they? So maybe politicians should be allowed the occasional absolute moronic stupid public statement and should go home and slap themselves around the face repeatedly till they feel better.
That's wrong for you. What do you think, Rachel? Would it have been better if there'd been a slightly more consistent line on this from the government?
Well, they said that stuff about taking the knee because they are trying to play this culture war. And I think that's a really dangerous game. They wanted to, they're trying to sort of pander to some elements of nastiness in the culture war, and by kind of criticizing the players who were taking the knee, which is absolutely their right and their choice. And you see the abuse they receive, you can understand why they do it. And the other players who, in solidarity with those who receive abuse. And then for politicians to get involved in criticising, it's them kind of playing to the worst, you know, parts of the country in a way that is, you know, it's really not what politicians should be doing. They should be fighting against that.
And this morning, GB News have got hold of a WhatsApp message from the Tory MP Natalie Elphick, which was sent around other Tory MPs last night, saying they lost. Would it be ungenerous to suggest Rashford should have spent more time perfecting his game and less time playing politics? I mean, you've interviewed Marcus Rashford, haven't you, Rachel?
I don't think the two are at odds with one another. He plays a huge amount. Well, I interviewed him just before Christmas and about he was campaigning for Fair Share, which is a food poverty charity, which we were raising money for with the Times. And he'd just come from training. He'd done absolutely masses of football. You know, I'm sure he's practiced penalties endlessly. They're not at odds with one another. In fact, I'd say they're, you know, to build your character in one way is going to build your character, or to build your character off the pitch is going to build your character on the pitch. And it's just ridiculous to, just because he managed to defeat the Tory party on free school meals than for churlish Tory MPs to criticise him is just absurd.
Yeah,
it's funny. I mean, it's actually funny the thought, you know, that any I can't think of any MP who could actually kick a ball without falling over themselves, telling Marcus Rashford to train better. I think everyone can see the absurdity in it.
Yes, it might have been better if Natalie Elphick had spent more time perfecting her politics and less time commenting on the game. Or would it be ungenerous to? Would it be ungenerous?
She's in
to
the wrong
that?
Shoes as well.
I will see how that. And just what do you think overall? What would be the impact on politics of all of this? Are the two things separate? Would it be better actually if politicians did keep out of football altogether? I suppose we'd have been, had England won last night, we'd have been asking the question: will there be a bounce in the polls, and who benefits from that? Or are the two things separate, and it's better that way, Libby?
I think pretty much separate. The interesting thing about it, though, is that politicians have to be aware of and following and understanding the national mood. And I think the whole England thing has been really important because England, it's been quite difficult to talk about England now among the four nations of the UK because you always sound like Sir Bufton Tufton and everybody thinks you want to get on a horse and gallop after a fox. You know, but actually a sense of Englishness, and that Englishness is now a diverse sort of team-building interracial, cheerful, hopeful, victorious, well-mannered thing has been magic. And so I think they can't sort of step right away from that. I think for them to applaud and love the England team is something they should do because it's a positive thing which has been happening in the consciousness, if you like, of the country.
Rachel?
What I thought was that the problem is when the politicians try to harness that positive mood for their own purposes. So you had some Tory MPs sort of taking bits of Gareth Southgate's letter about his father, his grandfather in the war and that form of patriotism and saying, oh, right, he's one of ours. And then you had the left taking the bit about tolerance and inclusivity and say, oh, he's one of ours. Actually, England is all of those things and both of those things. And that's what's been great about this team. But it is interesting that it's the England flag now, whereas in 1966 it was the Union Jack, wasn't it? And that is a sign of how the Union is changing, evolving, and there is this sense of English identity. But what I think Libby's absolutely right, it's not a sort of nationalistic you know, xenophobic little Englander. It's a tolerant, inclusive England that this team showed.
Yeah, and hopefully we can focus on all of that. We've had loads of messages in reflecting both what both of you have been saying. My favourite, I think, is someone's texted in saying, surely there must be a huge majority in favour of scrapping anonymity. And they haven't put their name on it.
Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester, watching the Weekend Globe in the Times every week. Just get yourself a digital subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, what you really need to know about Scottish politics.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to the Red Box podcast. Now, notebooks at the ready. This is what you really need to know about Scottish politics. You may remember, if you were listening last week, we had the Ruth Davidson, the former Scottish Conservative leader, on, and she ticked me off a couple of times about, well, I think it started with Northern Irish politics. I was getting that all wrong. And then she told me what people like me get wrong about Scottish politics.
I think the issue that people like you, and I say that in the broadest sense and without any sort of pejorativeness, misunderstand, is that the biggest issue on any given day isn't the Constitution.
So, is she right? And what else should we be talking about? What we're going to talk about now is we're going to try and give you five things you need to know about Scottish politics, joined by the man who knows, Kieran Andrews, the Times Scottish political editor, who is with me in the studio. Morning, Kieran.
Good morning, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm very good. I appreciate you flying down from Scotland just for this.
Well, absolutely. I wouldn't miss it for the world.
So, let's kick off then with the first thing, which is partly what's going to annoy Ruth, because we're doing it in the order of greatest irritation to Ruth Davidson, on the question of a Scottish independence referendum. What is the time? Where are we on the question? Because lots of people sort of become, in fact, a bit like a football tournament, when people get very into Scottish politics, there's an election, and then we forget all about it again until the next one comes round.
Yeah, they put the flags over the top of their suits and everyone gets very excited.
So what is the current state of Scottish politics?
Scottish politics is kind of on hiatus to a degree, certainly constitutional politics. After the Holyrood election, Nicola Sturgeon had said that she was going to have the first 100 days of government, which included parking the referendum. It was going to focus on rebuilding from the pandemic. Nicola Sturgeon wants a second independence referendum before the end of 2023, which means realistically autumn 2023, which isn't actually that far away. And the chances of that happening seem vanishingly small at the moment, mostly because Boris Johnson has said he doesn't want he will not agree to another referendum. Powers of the Constitution are reserved to the UK Parliament. And the only way to get around that is a potential court challenge. That takes time. And then, so if you consider going through, you know, we get to the... Nicola Sturgeon doesn't start asking for a referendum at the earliest until the back end of this summer. Boris Johnson says no. Even if you go straight to court, you've got to wait to go to court, wait for the result, the hearings, the judgment, and then agree the question, timetable and hold a referendum, doesn't seem likely.
Well, let's have a listen. This was Nicola Sturgeon setting out her timetable for a second independence referendum back in May.
I also said in this election I wanted to give people in Scotland the choice of independence, and I intend to do that when we are out of the crisis. The legislation, if a referendum is to be delivered within the first half of this Parliament, which is my preference, COVID permitting, we have to introduce the legislation in a time frame to facilitate that happening.
But, you know, Downing Street, Boris Johnson has repeatedly said that they won't give in to it. This was Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove speaking to The Telegraph a week or so ago, making clear that he can't see that happening anytime soon.
I think it's foolish to talk about a referendum now. We're recovering from COVID. We are still dealing with the health challenges that the COVID crisis has generated. And it seems to me to be at best reckless, at worst folly, to try to move the conversation on to constitutional division when people expect us to be working together in order to deal with these challenges.
So that is pretty clear. Your position is there will be no referendum before the 2024 election.
I can't see it.
That was Michael Gove speaking to the Daily Telegraph in the chill-out zone of a nightclub, for reasons that we're not to explain. No, this clearly this is just some music that they used on that clip. So the thing we need to know about Scottish politics is everyone's spoken for so long that if Nicola Sturgeon wins the elections in May 2021, there will be a second referendum. The thing we need to know is there probably won't be.
Probably won't be for... Well... A lot of it depends on two things, actually. One is, if the Scottish Government does take the UK Government to court over this, a lot of it will depend on the judgment of the Supreme Court. There's a lot of people in the UK Government very confident that they would win that case. There are others, you know, kind of senior unionist constitutional lawyers who think that actually it's not quite as cut and dried as that. The other thing that will be really important will be the next general election, whenever that's held. So I talked about, you know, we get to the point where we might know constitutionally whether the Scottish Government can hold its own referendum by, you know, the back end of 2023. Suddenly then, if there's a general election happening either just before that or quite soon afterwards, that becomes another crunch point, another key moment in terms of whether or not Scottish voters will express a wish and a will for a second independence referendum. Because that's kind of what's missing just now. Most polls show that voters, even if they're sympathetic towards independence, some of them, most of them don't think that now is the right time, which is why the UK government's kind of not now line works and holds because it resonates and it's captured the public mood. If that changes, then everything's back up in the air again.
Thanks so much, Kevin Andrews. So the first thing is Indoor F2 not happening anytime soon. Right, let's move on to the sort of the next thing we need to know about what's going on in Scottish politics. And one of the reasons why Downing Street, the Conservatives, are so reluctant to commit to a second referendum is they're not confident they would win it, not least because they're not sure who would run it, who would be overseeing it. And Downing Street's been through several versions of its efforts to save the union. Boris Johnson even appointed himself the Minister of the Union as he tried to ramp up the pro-union rhetoric at every opportunity.
Because it is time we unleashed the productive power, not just of London and the South East, but of every corner of England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. The awesome foursome that are incarnated in that red, white and blue flag, who together are so much more than the sum of their parts.
So that was Boris Johnson, I think, on the steps of Number 10 when he became Prime Minister. But the unionist movement in general and the Downing Street operation in particular has really struggled with the pro-union case, isn't it?
Well, it's funny hearing Boris Johnson there talk about flags, because that has been such a, you know, a recurring motif for the UK government in recent times, talking about this kind of muscular unionism. We'll invest some money in a project and drape a union flag on it, and that will strengthen support for the UK. And what the UK government's latest move, or Downing Street's latest move to try and strengthen support for the unions, to bring in a guy who most people have never heard of called Mark McInnes. He was is still the director of the Scottish Conservatives, and we're weaving that post to go be a special advisor on Number 10. Now, Mark McInnes was one of Team Ruth Davidson, you know, who was very influential in the strategy that saw the Scottish Conservatives have a relative resurgence in Scotland. And he's been brought in to try and, you know, impart some of that wisdom on Downing Street. Now, the interesting thing about this is in the 2016 election, when the Tories kind of broke through in Scotland, they had a no-flags policy. So how these strategies coexist will be, you know, quite interesting and key.
That's an interesting development, because when I asked Ruth Davidson last week if she would become Scottish Secretary in Boris Johnson's cabinet, she replied, no chance. So she completely sort of knocked that one on the head, in part, I think, because she wants a life, and partly because she still doesn't totally see eye to eye with Boris Johnson. Is this a sign that Number 10 is getting its act together? They finally realised that installing Westminster people in these jobs doesn't work, and actually people who know Scotland and Scottish politics is what's needed.
Well, it certainly feels like a bit of a moment of clarity. You know, you had Luke Graham, the former MP, who was in there before he was sacked, and he was a Scottish MP, but then he was sacked, and it's just been a turnover of people in Whitehall who seem to think that they know best about Scotland. So bringing in someone like Mark McInnes, I mean, who knows if it worked. With Davidson in an interview with The Times just after he was appointed, said that he'll be a great hire, but only if Boris Johnson listens to him. And I think that is the key and interesting thing. And McInnes has delivered advice that Downing Street's listened to before with poor polling, and they got rid of Jackson Carwell, the former Scottish Conservative leader, not long after that. So there is every reason to suspect he will be influential, and that could well increase support for the union.
Right, we are looking at five things you need to know about Scottish politics. Kevin Andrews, let's turn our attention to the opposition parties. How, you know, Scottish politics is just sort of dominated by Nicola Sturgeon, the SNP, with a bit of Boris Johnson, the Conservatives, thrown in for good measure. But there were other parties involved, of course. During the Holyrood elections, Scottish Labour tried to keep out of the constitutional issues. This was the leader, Anas Sarwar, saying the pandemic recovery was the key issue.
What people are going to see already tonight is bickering about old arguments, which is people's own interest, not the national interest. Because the mistake that both Douglas Ross and Nicola Sturgeon are both making is they only want to focus on the half of the country that agrees with them. And I think if you speak to people right across the country, what they are worried about right now isn't actually the date of a referendum. What they're worried about right now is keeping their loved ones safe, getting access to the vaccine, their children's education and mental health. They're worried about if and when they're going to have a job to go back to. They're worried about the cancelled operation or the failure to get a cancer diagnosis. Yes. They're worried about the planet that we're going to leave for our children and
I'm
our grandchildren. That's what this election campaign should be all about.
That was Anas Sarwar back in the election campaign. However, we've heard many times from the Scottish polling guru, Professor Sir John Curtis, who says that too often the opposition parties are too preoccupied with just attacking Nicola Sturgeon without any great success.
Truth is that the opposition parties have indeed tried to do their damnedest to try to bring Ms. Sturgeon down. In truth, that seemed to be their principal objective rather than necessarily being concerned about the ways in which indeed the harassment procedure perhaps was flawed in conception and certainly flawed in operation.
So, Kieran Andrews, what do we need to know about the opposition parties? What current state are they in? If they, even after all these years of the SNP dominance, they haven't really worked out what to do about them.
They haven't, and both the Scottish Conservatives and Scottish Labour are starting from almost, not quite, but almost blank canvases following this election. Both have relatively new leaders in Douglas Ross and Anas Sarwar. Both have pretty much empty backroom teams that they're trying to fill at the moment, and the people they appoint there will signal, you know, the kind of direction they're going to take. But both have quite big opportunities as well. The Scottish Conservatives held all their seats at the last election, which was seen as a good result for them, albeit way, way, way back in second place, the SNP dominant, obviously. And now they will have to make the decision as to whether they want to continue to push hard on the constitution to fire up that base in the way that they did successfully in May, or whether they want to broaden out and present themselves as an alternative party of government. Similarly, Scottish Labour, it seems a bit more clear-cut about where Anas Sarwar is taking the party. That rhetoric he showed at the election, trying to present himself as the kind of reasonable grown-up in the room. And again, he will want to be presenting policies that will win back mostly people who traditionally voted Labour in Scotland but shifted to the SNP and maybe support independence. He'll want to draw them back on side. Because the thing is, the SNP, when they got into power in 2007, they did so after holding this big kind of crisis summit where they decided that for too long they'd just been sniping and shouting, being negative at Scottish Labour, who seemed all-powerful and all-conquering and would never be knocked out of government in Scotland. And the SNP put themselves forward as an alternative government, sneaked in 2007, and the rest, well, is history. And it needs the opposition parties need to, you know, if they want to have any sort of success, they need to take a leaf out of that book from the SNP and present themselves as somebody who could actually be in power, rather than just people saying that the SNP, you know, picking at the SNP's flaws and saying what a bad job they're doing.
What's the sort of interaction between Anas Sarwar and Keir Starmer, Douglas Ross and Boris Johnson? Because Nicola Sturgeon obviously loves to paint everyone else as a sort of creature of Westminster. How far can they go in distance themselves from the leader? Are they trying to do that?
Well, they're quite different. In Keir Starmer, Anas Sarwar, somebody has a UK leader who he's broadly on the same page with. He has said that Scottish Labour is an autonomous body. You know, Scottish Labour has never quite got over that branch office accusation that was thrown at it by its former leader Joanne Lamont when she quit after the independence referendum. So Anas Sarwar's trying to create a bit of distance, but it's not like it was when Jeremy Corbyn was in charge and there was a leader who was saying vastly different things that the Scottish party saw as being unhelpful. Slightly different with Douglas Ross and Boris Johnson. You know, Douglas Ross every so often has to pick a fight with the Prime Minister just to try and, you know, make it perfectly clear that the Scottish Conservatives are not following exactly the same
thing. Is that all sort of authorised and sanctioned by Number 10? Do they agree in advance what they're going to fall out about in public?
I think it's probably a mixture, to be honest. I wouldn't say that necessarily Douglas Ross's pushbacks against the Prime Minister are authorised, but Downing Street definitely knows that this is something
it's
that's going to happen.
Part of the game.
But then we saw a few months ago, in the run-up to the election, there's some briefings to lobby journalists from Number 10 that were starting to get a bit hacked off with Douglas Ross. You know, maybe he's not the right man for the job. And again, maybe that's all part of the game. Maybe that's in there to talk up the issues. But, you know, Douglas Ross,
he said he'd been there 5 minutes.
Well, exactly. And he is the person who quit he was the only minister who quit over the Dominic Cummings Barnard Castle trip. So the idea that he just does things for show, because at that point he wasn't Scottish Conservative leader, it didn't look like Jackson Carroll was leaving. So, you know, he does things because he thinks that's what he should do. And, you know, sometimes it'll be because it's politics, sometimes it'll be because, you know, he believes in it.
We should just touch on the Lib Dems. Previously, they used to, you know, be one of the dominant forces in Scottish politics. Where are they? Are they they've got very excited in England about Chesham and Amersham and so on. Is there any sign of the Lib Dems the great long-awaited Lib Dem fight back happening in Scotland?
No.
Right. Very good. Right. I think the thing we've learned now is to sort of just keep an eye on, particularly Anasawa and what he's... Both Anasawa and Douglas Ross and their interactions with their own leaders and whether or not they can sort of chip away at the SNP. Let's move on to the fourth thing that we need to know about Scottish politics and the interaction between the SNP and the Green Party. The SNP got the most seats, but not an overall majority. But we're still in a position where they're still talking about what the deal is with the Green Party. Is that right?
Yeah, so... The SNP fell one seat short of an overall majority at Horrocks, so comfortable control, meaning that any big votes, budgets and the like, they'll find a way to get through. They've done that over the last few years, negotiating both with the Greens and actually with the Liberal Democrats. Now what's been talked about is making it a bit more formal with the Greens. They're avoiding talk of coalitions after the Conservative Lib Dem coalition. They're talking about a cooperation agreement, which is nice and wooey and vague and means we don't really know what it will look like, although it could see a couple of Green MSPs becoming ministers.
How is that not then a coalition? If they're voting together and they're sitting around the table, how is that different to a coalition? Is it purely semantics?
It's entirely spin. but again, I think that is because they don't know if that's what will happen yet. In fairness, if it ends up with a couple of Green ministers and they're all whipped by collective responsibility, and of course it's a coalition agreement, but it could be something looser than that. And it's good PR ahead of COP26, which has been hosted in Glasgow, obviously, and for the Scottish government, who feel a bit sidelined in all of this because it's a UK government event. Scottish government have their own little venue just over the water to say, look at how great we are. So having the Greens in government would be a nice PR boost for them. So, but it will be interesting to see what policies they get through.
And what's the timescale on this? Because obviously the elections happen back in May. The Scottish Parliament has now risen for the summer break, so there's no sort of pressing issue. But is there a point at which they need to have done a deal? Or is it just the case where the Greens are going to vote with them anyway? So there's not actually a crunch point.
There's no crunch point. Talks are going on over the summer. I suspect if we don't have anything by early days after Holyrood comes back in September, then we're probably looking at there being no agreement because it feels like what's the point in dragging it right through? But there's no rush. There's no crunch end date on it.
And the key thing is, and I remember speaking to I think Jonathan Bartley the and Sean Berry from the Green Party in England. They make quite clear they are completely separate to the Green Party in Scotland, because the Green Party in Scotland. Let's take a listen to Patrick Harvey, leader of the Green Party in Scotland. He was making quite clear that they just agree with the SNP on the issue of independence.
Our members decide what our position is on independence, and they have consistently over many years, in fact in a larger proportion over the years, supported not only the principle of independence but absolutely the democratic right of the people of Scotland to choose. And look, if there was a pro-union majority, a majority from Labour, the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats opposed to independence, I would of course have to accept reluctantly the democratic legitimacy of saying there shouldn't be a referendum in this new session. All that's required is that they accept the same basic democratic principle that the people of Scotland have made a decision about their parliament. Their parliament will make a decision about a referendum, and then they will make a decision about their future.
That was Patrick Harvey, the Green Party leader. Right, let's move away from the constitution, as Ruth Davidson told me off for last week. And focus on some of those domestic issues. In fact, let's take a listen to... this was Ruth Davidson when she appeared on the show on Thursday, making clear that the mistakes that people like I make are always focusing on the Constitution.
The biggest issue on any given day isn't the Constitution. It's the fact that people in Scotland care about their kids' school. They care about the fact that the, COVID has affected the health service to the point that the backlogs are a mile long and you turn a corner and then are a mile further down the road. They care about the fact that actually, there's some really good businesses that went under, or there's people hanging by a thread. The idea that Scotland is siloed and different, I think, is the big issue. And the idea that the Constitution is the big Scottish issue all the time, it's just not.
Kieran Andrews, I did point out to Ruth Davidson that as someone who fought several election campaigns entirely on the Constitution, we said no, say no again, and all of that. And I remember going and standing on the sort of election events where Ruth Davidson was holding up placards to that effect. So if anyone is responsible for constantly putting the Constitution on the table, the Conservatives share some of the blame for that.
Including Meath's election just passed, yes.
Exactly, exactly that. So, but let's focus on those domestic issues, because actually this feels like the area where there's most to gain for some of the opposition parties that we were just discussing, because the SNP's domestic record on schools and hospitals and whatever else isn't good. So how have they managed to continue to dominate so much in Scotland?
Well, that's partly the area that Anas Sarwar was trying to move into during the election, and again is showing that he's trying to move into following that, you know, is to concentrate on domestic issues, domestic policies. You know, the health service in Scotland has the same sort of issues that we're going to be seeing across the UK, a massive backlog of operations, you know, cancer screenings and routine operations that are, you know, that is not going away. We've got last week three hospitals in Scotland, three health boards in Scotland went into code black, which is effectively they can't take any more patients because of the number of COVID cases. It's only going to increase that. There's a big problem with bed blocking before the pandemic, and that's showing signs of coming back. So there's real strains on the health service that are partly due to COVID, but partly because of the way the health service is currently run.
And schools has also been an issue for the SNP, isn't it?
Yeah, this year was another crisis in terms of exam results. I said there weren't exams, it was just tests sat under conditions where you can't look at any notes and a teacher's observing you, which sounds kind of like an exam. The Scottish Government has scrapped its education body and its qualifications body, and has said it's going to push for some radical reforms, but they promised this after 2016 and backed down in the face of opposition from the education establishment and the unions. So it'll be a big challenge to see if they can, you know, if they can turn that round this time and really prove, you know, if they can show why Scotland should be an independent country because they are running the domestic policies and, you know, the big domestic issues very well, then that would, of course, increase support for independence.
OK, so then looking ahead, when the Scottish Parliament comes back in the autumn, what's the single thing we should be looking out for? How can we impress our friends to say, well, the thing that you really need to look out for in Scottish politics is...
Well, this is going to anger Ruth Davidson. It's going to be the draft independence bill and what it says, how it's framed, whether it's going to the Supreme Court. That's going to be the biggest battle over the coming months and years.
Sorry, Ruth. We did try. Kieran Andrews, it's been a brilliant insight for you to talk us through. So the five things we've learned: the timing on the Indy ref is really tricky. Boris Johnson needs to listen to Mark McInnes if he's going to try and get the sort of the union unit back on the road. He's definitely one to watch. That's one to drop into your dinner parties with your friends. Number three, the Labour Party seems to be back and trying to, you know, in a way that it hasn't been for a while.
Is that fair? It has an opportunity. The next five
it
years
might be back.
It might be. I mean, it has a reasonably credible UK leader and a credible Scottish leader.
When's a coalition not a coalition? When it's a cooperation agreement with the Green Party who get ministers and vote the way that they want to. And finally, domestic policy does matter. But it possibly ought to matter slightly more than it does, because it's all about the second referendum. Kieran, it's lovely to see you. Kieran Andrews, Scottish political editor of The Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Matt.
And hopefully that was useful. Now you can impress your friends at dinner parties that you'll all be having with 200 people from next week in England anyway. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not rate and review us wherever you get your podcast from?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.